This is your host, Silas Dean, and this is a Creep Time original podcast, The Sinister. So please make sure to go check out Creep Time, the podcast, right after this show.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Well, you can't trust County.
I think the betrayal of trust is really one of the most common themes that we see in all of these stories. We see people feeling betrayed from the police, from their friends, from people they thought they knew. They thought they knew who this person was, from their families. But this one hits particularly hard. It is this chilling story about two people who had kind of overcome the odds of life in different ways and then would rekindle and found each other, and it seemed like a really happy ending. But it would take a turn. It was a turn that I don't think anybody saw coming, and it was a turn from somebody that they thought they knew, somebody they could trust. It was in 2005 when Carol and Reggie, an older couple who were retired in Jacksonville, Florida, were first reported missing by Carol's daughter. This tip would take police down a trail that was far more disturbing than they anticipated. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of The Sinister with Silas. I'm your host, Silas Dean, and every week I come right on here, I hang out with you right after an episode of Creep Time, the podcast, and I cover the eeriest stories that I know. So please make sure to follow and subscribe to this podcast, turn on the bell notification so that you never have to miss an episode, and if you feel so inclined, you can leave us a review. You can also share this podcast. It really does help to get the stories of The Sinister out to more people. Thanks again for stopping by, and with that, let's get into our story. So to tackle this case, we really have to start by going back in time. We're going to go to the 1960s, where we'll follow two high schoolers. They're in South Carolina. They are high school sweethearts, completely inseparable. So their names were Carol and Reggie, and as sweet as the relationship was, it really did not last beyond that of high school. So they go their separate ways, they break up. Reggie would end up joining the military, and then he eventually goes off, gets married, eventually gets divorced. Carol also ended up getting married twice, but her second marriage ended in a near fatality. So after Carol had divorced her second husband, she's living alone with her 10-year-old daughter, Rhonda. The second husband, this is February of 1987, shows up at her door, gun in hand, shoots her close to 6 times. Now, she does recover, miraculously, but she's going to have lifelong injuries, debilitating injuries. She is partially blind in one eye. She will have lifelong pain, but she does survive the attack. So this had kind of drastically changed the relationship because he takes his life after this, and Rhonda, the 10-year-old daughter, she has to step up and help her mom. She's a single mom, and she now needs a caretaker. So she's 10, taking care of her mom full-time, and if matters could not get any worse, she gets some devastating news. Carol would end up in the hospital where she is diagnosed with liver cancer, but it is not what you think. It didn't come from any sort of excessive alcohol. It wasn't even something that was genetic or running in her family. When she received a blood transfusion during her initial attack, the blood she was given was not tested and had hepatitis B, which eventually resulted in the liver cancer. So it's just blow after blow, constant devastation for this woman. But she is determined to get her life back on track, even though she has been dealt a horrible hand. Of course, she does have limitations because of her past injuries, but she eventually goes out and she's able to obtain a job as a customer service rep. While on the phone one day, talking to customers per usual, she gets a call from a man named Reggie, and she immediately thinks of that high school sweetheart. So she kind of goes out on a limb and she goes, "You're not this Reggie by chance, are you?" Absolutely, it was him. So they have a huge rekindling. It's a big reconnect on the phone. They talk about their lives, things that have happened, their marriages. They realize that, you know, they're both single at this point. And it's such a positive exchange, just per chance, that they take it as a sign. Maybe we should get together, you know, because we live really close. Let's meet up, which they do so. And at this point, it's a really positive and exciting turn in Carol's life. She expressed to her daughter, Rhonda, that she was feeling optimistic. She felt like things were turning around, and it wasn't long before her and Reggie met up. And once again, the two became inseparable. So from the point of view here, from Rhonda, the daughter, all she could say about her mother, Carol, was that once again, she had completely fallen in love with him. And it wouldn't take long. It was actually about 6 months before the two decided we should get married. And they do so. They end up selling both of their homes in South Carolina, and then the two of them move down to retire in Jacksonville, Florida. So to kind of place this in the timeline of events, this is right around the year 2000, and it seems like a very positive turn in this woman's life. She was dealt a horrific hand. She's rekindled, refound love with someone that she knew more than 40 years ago, and now they're retiring together. It seems like the perfect love story. So when does this all go wrong? So we fast forward to 2005, about 5 years later, and over this five-year period, Rhonda is staying in touch with her mother pretty consistently. You know, she's calling her every so often. She's checking in on how the relationship is doing, how's Florida, etc. It's really no cause for concern until July of 2005, when she suddenly can't get a hold of her. Can't reach her mother for whatever reason, so she lets that first call go. Then a few hours pass, keeps trying again, still cannot get a hold of her. And after 24 hours pass, and she still can't reach her mother, she starts to suspect that something could be wrong here, because as independent as Carol was at this point, she still requires some care. You know, she needs a caregiver. And at this point, Reggie also kind of needed a caregiver, because Reggie has diabetes. He is a diabetic, and he also recently broke his leg at this point. So if Rhonda can't get a hold of either of them, that's cause for concern. Now, days after this, they would pass of Rhonda sort of incessantly trying to call her mother and Reggie. She cannot get a hold of them until eventually, for whatever reason, she just decides, rather than call the police at this point, maybe have them do a wellness check, I'm going to get in my car. I am going to drive straight to Jacksonville, Florida. It's about 4 hours from this point of South Carolina. So she arrives at the home, and the first thing she notices, the car is not in the driveway. Major concern. She gets out of the car. She goes to their door. Gets inside the house. A few red flags right off the bat. The family dog is still there. Has not had water, has not had food for, it looks like, maybe a few days. Very, very unlike them. There's also food on the counter. There are dirty dishes in the sink. There is medication that's left there. Life-saving daily medication that both of them need. Reggie for his diabetes and Carol for her liver cancer treatment. Very unusual. Something seems wrong. So she immediately calls the police, and it's not long after this that the story sort of breaks in the news. There is a couple, an older couple, that has mysteriously gone missing. The police search would eventually commence, where they do find the car, which is abandoned on the side of the road, but the battery has been removed. Again, there's really no telling at this point which direction the story is going. It almost seemed like maybe they were just leaving and they ran into car trouble. They had the battery removed or put into another car. It just, none of it made sense. It was so unlike them. But then we get a tip that comes into a police station. It is a man that calls on the phone, and he says something very interesting. So it's a man's voice on the phone that calls into the station, and there is a recording of this, and he sounds pretty young. They would probably place his voice somewhere of a guy in his 20s. He is claiming he's Reggie. He says, I'm Reggie Sumner. I just saw that we're on the news everywhere. People think we're missing. We are not missing. We just took off. We're on a couple's vacation. Please, please, please call off the search. Police are very suspicious of this because, again, he does not sound like an older man. So they ask, you know, is Carol with you, your wife? And he says, yes. They say, put her on the phone. Hands the phone off. A woman gets on the phone. Again, sounds extremely young, possibly like 17, 18-year-old girl on the phone who's saying, yep, I'm Carol, etc. Not an older woman's voice. So they're suspicious of this. They kind of let the call be and just keep them on as long as they can to put a trace on the call, which would take a little bit of time. They have a recording of that call. They call in Rhonda to listen to these voices. They say, is this your mother? Is this Reggie? It is not. She has no idea who those people are, why they would be calling in to say, no, we're them, we're not missing, we're fine. But we can assume they logically have something to do with the disappearance. So initially, they're putting the trace on the call. They are also looking back into the bank statements of their joint credit cards. They end up finding there's a transaction. It might have been from one of their debit cards, actually, back in South Carolina. So they're no longer even in Florida at this point, whoever's, you know, doing this. They get the CCTV footage from that transaction. It shows a man who is using one of their cards in his 20s. Not them. Most definitely has something to do with what happened to them. So at this point, they're trying to trace the call. It ends up going nowhere. It's traced back to a fake name, a fake address. It's a dead end. But they've got another way forward here. So here's where we get into some real, like, police work on this. They are able to go through the call log, even though it was traced back to a fake name, a bogus address. They can get a full list of those call logs, one of which goes to a car dealership or a car rental company. So they contact the car rental company. They're able to basically cross-reference to match the phone number with the rental. That's connected back to the CCTV footage. Yep, that's the same type of car that's seen in the background connected to this guy. So then they get a name. But funny enough, it was actually not the guy who was seen in the CCTV footage who allegedly rented the car. It was Tiffany Cole, presumably the woman who was heard on the phone pretending to be Carol. Now, that would seem like the end of the road, but luckily, all of these cars, even in 2005, had satellite tracking capabilities. They can figure out where that rental is. So they are able to track the rental, and it would take them all the way to this motel somewhere in South Carolina. They go there, police, with search warrant in hand. They go straight to the front desk. They get a key to the room where they know they are staying, and they burst through that door. Inside, there were three people. There was Tiffany in that room. It was the guy who was seen at the ATM in the CCTV footage, and there is a third friend who is there. The room is littered with stuff that they very clearly just stole and or bought. It looked like they had the coin collection of Reggie. It looked like they had the keys to the car. I mean, they are very, very clearly connected to the disappearance of this older couple. So all of them are taken into custody. They're brought into the station. They are separated for the interrogation, which was very smart, but they are completely mute, uncooperative, until Tiffany cracks just a little bit. She is claiming that they robbed them, but that's all they did. They had nothing else to do with their disappearance. All they did was take their stuff. But she also gave them something invaluable because she lets them know that a fourth person was involved. She leads them to Bruce Nixon. He was a 19-year-old who would have been the fourth person, the fourth accomplice. He is brought in. He breaks almost instantly. And the story that this kid would tell police was chilling. So to really break down this story, Tiffany, this girl, she is connected back to the Sumners, to Carol and Reggie, from a while back. She used to be their neighbor back in South Carolina when they lived there before they retired. So she had a difficult upbringing. She was not in a good place with her family. I believe her father was sick. So the Sumners had sort of taken this girl under their wing because, you know, they had been through hardships themselves, Carol more than anyone, and they had helped her out when she needed. They would let her stay over. They eventually sold her a car for essentially nothing. I mean, they really treated this girl very well. So when they eventually moved, they were still in contact with this girl. And they said, you know, if you're ever in the Jacksonville, Florida area, if you need anything, let us know. Fast forward, Tiffany is in the Jacksonville, Florida area. Something falls through with her housing for that night with her and her friends, or they're getting kicked out. But what she remembers, Carol and Reggie, the Sumners, they live in Jacksonville. She remembers where they live. So she makes her way unannounced to the home, knocks on the door. They open it, and of course, she is greeted with open arms. Carol answers the door. She goes, oh my God, I can't believe you're here. Please come on in. Let me make you food. What can we do for you? What can we do to help? She allows them to stay there overnight. So while they're sitting down, they're all kind of eating. Reggie is there as well. And they're talking about things. They talk about the sale of their house back in South Carolina. Carol or Reggie, one of them had mentioned that in the sale, they had made close to $100,000 in profit. This set something off in Tiffany, a very sinister idea. She turned to the guy who she was with at the Sumner's house, and she knew what he was thinking. We're going to rob this couple, but they couldn't do it that night. So by the following morning, they do leave. They leave very early and they come up with their plan. It would take a couple of days and they would rope in two other accomplices because don't forget, it is four people total here who are involved. They have a plan to come back, exploit and rob the Sumners. So two guys, the accomplices, they end up showing up, knock on the door, very unsuspecting. And of course, Carol answers. She does not know who they are. And they say, our car broke down. Could we possibly come in so we could use your phone? She is a very generous woman, a little hesitant, but she still allows them to come into the house to use the phone, at least to call for help. The second they do, they draw a gun. It's not a real gun, but she doesn't know that. So she thinks she's at gunpoint. They instruct her to get down on the ground. They kind of wrestle her. They're tying her up, restraining her. Reggie comes running in. He has the broken leg at this point. Don't forget, they restrain him as well. Eventually, they sat both of them on the couch, duct taped both of their heads completely so that they can't see. They can't even scream. All they have is a little narrow slit under their nose so they can still breathe. So then Tiffany and Michael, the other two, they get the go ahead to come in the house. All four ransack the place. They take every single valuable they can possibly find, put it into the two cars that they have, and you would think that would be it. Not quite. They then lead Carol and Reggie into the trunk of one of the cars, and both cars take off. Now, Tiffany had scoped out a spot for the next phase of the plan. Both cars would travel about 40 minutes where they were going to cross over the border into Georgia, where they get down an access road that leads into a very remote forest. And when they arrive there, the Sumners are removed from the trunk because what Tiffany and Michael had done just 2 days prior is they had dug graves for the Sumners. Now, when they initially popped the trunk, it had been extremely hot in there. So, of course, a lot of the sweat had built up on both Reggie and Carol. So the duct tape that was around their face, that was restraining their eyes, their wrists, it had slipped off. So the second they opened that, they're very weak. They're extremely overheated. This is an older couple. They get a good look at the people who are doing this to them because don't forget, they had been blinded for most of this. They have no idea that Tiffany is involved. It is in this moment that they see the girl that they have known for years, the girl who they helped, the girl who they let stay at their home, the girl who they sold a car to those years ago, stayed in their home just days ago. She is now an accomplice in this plot. So they get them out of the trunk. They're very weak. And don't forget, Reggie has a broken leg. They throw them to the ground and then kick both of them together into the plot. They are inside this hole that is dug out in the ground. So they're in there, they're sobbing, they're terrified. And initially, it sounds like what the plot here was for was kind of a scare tactic. So the initial thinking was that they would get them in there and it would scare them enough to give over any of their information. We're talking like social security numbers, ATM pins, all of their banking information, anything these four can possibly use to extort more money from them. And of course, this couple is terrified. They're giving them anything they want. They give every single pin, every single number. They say, you can have everything, anything you want. Please just don't hurt us. Once they get all of that information, they decide it's not enough. They can't take the risk of having these people know who they were. So they begin to bury them alive. The couple is so weak at this point, so injured, so exhausted. They cannot move from the position inside the plot that they had been kicked into. So piece by piece, all four of them, Tiffany included, while looking down, begin to shovel and pile dirt on top of them. They do so in a very methodic way. They are shoveling basically from the feet up. So the dirt is slowly building on the lower half to the midpoint of their body, crushing them under the weight of this soil. They're still breathing. It's very shallow. But eventually, it gets to the point of their face. They are whimpering. They are struggling. They are begging. They begin to pile dirt directly onto their faces. While they continue to pile this dirt and they are buried under one, two, three, several feet of the soil, it is described later in the testimony, the couple can be heard from underground screaming and begging for help. It was not an immediate death. It was slow. It was horrific. Following this, All four of them got back into the two cars. They abandon the car that belonged to Carol and Reggie back in Florida, remove the battery, and then got back into the rental. They take all of the banking information, go to the ATM, which is what we see on that CCTV footage, and they go on a shopping spree. All four of them took part in this, all while knowing in the same day that they had just buried this couple alive. I mean, it was a tragic and disturbing way to die. It was very slow, and eventually, once the medical examiner comes out with their autopsy, they found that the couple had soil all in their nose, their mouths, down their throat, their lungs, and stomach. They had effectively choked to death on the soil that was burying them alive. It was devastating, and it was unimaginable that these four could have done this, especially given Tiffany's history with this couple. But in return for Bruce Nixon basically uncovering and exposing the story, he would be the only one of the four who was spared the death penalty. Alan Wade, Mike Jackson, and Tiffany Cole were sentenced to death for their crimes against Carol and Reggie. It is such a horrific story, I think, for anybody who hears it, but really just, you know, to think about Carol and how she was dealt blow after blow and eventually overcomes the odds, but meets her end in such a senseless way and by somebody she thought she could trust. I think anybody who listened to this, anybody who was involved in the investigation, they felt for this story. And specifically, I really feel for her daughter. It's just so awful to think about what these four did. But I do think this is an important story to cover. I think it's a story that did not get nearly as much coverage. But that is where it ends. I want to thank everybody for listening. Thank you for stopping by for this episode of The Sinister. And of course, as always, I am going to catch you on the next one.